Hi, I'm Ethan Lawrence, and welcome to the Rogue Monkey Podcast.
Well, there are no surprises for guessing who today's guest is. That's right, we are speaking to actor Ethan Lawrence, star of Bad Education, Afterlife, Horrible Histories, and most recently, Magic Mike 3, The Last Dance. Our conversation is a great insight into the acting industry, and Ethan is both humble and honest about the journey he has taken and the lessons learned. We did have a lot of questions on social media from our listeners after announcing the recording, and I did do my absolute best to get every single one weaved into our interview. So a big thank you for everyone who messaged in. So with that, we're going to get straight into it, and episode 86 of the Rogue Monkey Podcast, featuring actor Ethan Lawrence. Hello, Ethan. Welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Yourself?
Yeah, very grateful, very excited to kind of share your story and your journey with our listeners. But can you give us, a bit of an introduction as to who you are?
I'm Ethan Lawrence. I'm a large actor and comedy man you may know me from Bad Education, Afterlife, all sorts of things like that. 11 years professional acting experience at this point. So there's, but what I don't know about the industry ain't worth knowing. And a lot of what I do know about the industry isn't worth knowing either.
Well, I think we're going to dive into a blend of both. So to start with, I've got some questions that have come in from listeners and viewers, because we did a post last week to let everyone know we'd be speaking to you. So a couple of things to get us started. How would you describe the acting industry in just three words, now having been in it for a while?
Difficult, but rewarding. Would be the way. I mean, it's never been thus. Like, it's a famously hard industry to crack, but like, you know, it's been very good to me, and like, you know, I can't really picture myself really doing anything else. So for all the heartache and the blowbacks and the pain, it all comes good when like it finally comes together. You know what I mean?
So, if you then had to describe your journey specifically, how does that follow, I guess, In the same pattern, three words to describe your journey through that acting industry, what's it been like?
Luck then grift would be the key thing. I mean, I'm sure we'll get to it as the interview continues, but like, you know, I had a lucky break early doors, and then since then it's just about generating your own luck, just, you know, working as hard as you can to keep things going. And that's essentially what I've been doing. Once you get that break, then it's time to really start putting the legwork in.
I find it interesting, and as you said, I'm sure we'll get into a few more of these sorts of bits later, but the thing that I find when I speak to successful people is often there, and it is, you know, very a gracious reference to luck. And I think, you know, my day job in sport, I see what I'd consider like physical graft to the absolute extreme, and then I see incredible performances, and I don't see anything to do with luck. I think you've worked extremely hard to get where you are. So it's a compliment to you to start us off, because I think there is of course an element of luck to it, but equally the amount of grafting and the amount of interviews and all of these things you have to do to get over the line. I just cannot imagine how difficult it's been. So
do you
kind of reflect back and think, how have I got here? Do you have moments like that where you kind of almost pinch yourself moments?
They call it imposter syndrome, don't they? It's very much like, you know, sometimes when you sort of like, when you're working and everything's going well, there is that sort of little devil on your shoulders going, this will all end soon. Eventually they're going to come up and be like, right, okay, you've had your fun. Time to go back. Come on. And it's taken a lot of, like, you know, mental work to try and quieten that little demon devil down, because, you know, essentially, especially early doors, like I couldn't believe what was happening to me. Like, it was absurd that, like, you know, this little kid from a small town is now, like, you know, chopping it up with the big boys. And it's never really gone away, but you learn to mitigate it more than anything else, I would say.
Do you find that almost like monkey on your shoulder keeps you half grounded, in a sense, in that you don't get too carried away or complacent?
Oh, absolutely. And like, you know, I've seen it happen. It's so easy to get swept up in your own brilliance in this industry, because, like, you know, it's a show-offy industry, and like, you know, we're very well looked after as actors. So it's, you know, you start to believe your own hype. But as you say, it's important to remember, and it's, you know, partly, you know, as much as it sucks to think about it, it is good in a sense that you remember this can all go, and it won't take much. Like, you know, just it's because basically being an actor is like being a shark. You've essentially just got to keep swimming, because if you stop, you drown. Yeah. Because it's all based on momentum and, like, you know, using previous things to then plant the seeds for other things moving forward. And that's essentially where the graft lives. It's, you know, building up relationships, getting credits, doing everything you can, like, you know, making sure that people recognize you as a safe pair of hands.
We'll come on to some more of that, I'm sure. But I'm curious, going back to, I guess, the early years before, you know, you made it and you did have that break. What was kind of your first memories of going, I actually want to do this? Like, this is an industry I actually want to make a choice to go into.
So I caught the bug when I was 11, just straight up doing drama at school. You know, it wasn't something that was available at primary school at the time. So joining secondary school and, like, actually sort of getting to sort of do curricular drama, I noticed that, you know, I had a knack for it. And I was like, okay, well, this seems like it could be fun. But, like, you know, especially when you're 11, like, you know, you think to yourself, I will be an actor. I remember telling my mum this. I was like, yeah, you know, I'm going to be an actor. And she was like, yeah, okay. So make sure you do actually get a real job as well, because let's be honest, you're going to be spending a lot of time doing that instead of acting. But, you know, it was always at the back of my mind. And, like, throughout my teens, I did near enough everything I could to be, well, to sort of further that dream. Like, you know, I went and did loads of amateur musical theatre. Like, you know, because really the best way to learn acting is to, you know, act. Yeah, you can be taught it theoretically to a certain extent, but experience is everything. And when I turned 18, started applying to, or maybe not 18, maybe it was probably 17, started applying to drama schools, you know, again, with a view to keeping this all going. I didn't get into any of them because I'm a hack and a fraud. So I went to university instead to study drama and creative writing, and then that's where I got my lucky break. Just a random audition falling on my lap, which turned out to be bad education. So it's a blessed life I've led. No doubt about it.
I cast my mind back to first year of university, and lucky breaks is probably not how I would characterise my first year of university. And I think when you got to the end of that first year, the whirlwind of both the first year of university, if you like, but also having that first break, what kind of, did you feel like things changed gears at that point? Or, you know, what was that experience like as a student that perhaps a lot of other people can go, I can remember first year of uni, but I didn't have a life-changing moment, if you like?
Well, so, like, the first year, especially on the course that I was on, was sort of a bit of a dummy year. Like, you know, it's set you up for years 2 and 3, but, you know, it didn't actually count towards your final grade. That's not said I didn't take it seriously, but it was more sort of like, okay, I've got the time to breathe. And then when bad education came along, like, again, that monkey on our shoulder that we've been talking about, it was, you know, I went and did the 6 weeks of the shoot and then got back at the end of it and was like, right, well, that's that then. You know, I didn't really see it going anywhere, because, you know, why would you? It was such an unknown quantity. And it's only once that year ended and we got recommissioned for another series, and it was like, oh, you're coming back and there's even more to do, where I was sort of like, oh, okay. And in the end, I completed my degree alongside the first few years of professional acting, which was ultimately, I think, potentially a mistake, because I was very busy. But, you know, I have a very expensive piece of paper now, so that's good.
Talking of expensive pieces of paper, one of the things I wanted to ask was about investment, if you like, and over, again, being this wise, experienced actor that you are now, what has been the best investment of your time up to this point?
Best investment of my time? I would really credit those teenage years. Because, you know, I've said it before, I'll say it again, like, you know, experience is how you learn how to be an actor. And I was very lucky to have a good teacher. Gary Sullivan was his name. He passed away recently, which was very sad. But, you know, he coached me, essentially. Like, you know, he gave me opportunities in plays and in musicals to, like, do some stuff. I think he potentially may have seen something in me that was good. So, like, you know, it wasn't always the main character or whatever, but he knew that whatever he gave me, I'd do to the best of my abilities. And I credit that with not only learning how to act, like, as a discipline, but also not being too proud to take on any role. You know, it taught me to be humble, essentially. And, you know, remember that there's no such thing as small parts, only small actors. And it's good to have that mentality, especially, like, early doors starting out, because you've got to grab any opportunity you can find with both hands. And it's something that, you know, I still do now. Like, you know, it's very, 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 very rarely do I turn down something that's offered. And it's, you know, it's just a good mindset to have, I think.
100%. And I know, you know, we'd messaged last week and you mentioned about watching one of the other episodes as kind of a bit of a preparation as to what you were getting yourself into. And Lauren, who you looked at, her brother is a stuntman, does quite a lot of the Marvel films. And I saw him in a KFC advert recently, and I texted him and was like, what was that all about? And he's like, got to pay the bills.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that you say that, because I think it doesn't really matter what industry you're in. As soon as I think you almost get in your mind above your pay grade, if you like, and start thinking you're too good to do certain things, I think that can actually be quite a slippery slope, because that, and then I guess, permeates your reputation that others see and think, oh, do we want to work with that person? And it's almost the opposite to what you said at the start. You want to create that image and that perception and trust in who you are as an actor to go, actually, that's somebody we do want to work with.
For sure, for sure. And, like, you know, it's. I think part of it is the people are sort of transfixed by sort of the glamour of acting, you know, because it seems from the outside to be sort of like, you know, all sunshine and roses. But, like, you know, even your top tier talents, you know, your Tom Cruises, your Leonardo DiCaprio's, I'm sure they did some absolute rubbish in their early careers. But, you know, it's all about getting the credit, and in their case, getting into SAG-AFTRA or whatever. So, and now look at them, global superstars each. And then there's also me as well. I'm trying.
It's been a really interesting kind of journey watching you, because I remember watching the first series, Bad Education. And that, yeah, that was, where are we now, 2023. So, you know, it's more than a decade ago.
Was it, we did the reunion special just last year, which was sort of a strange, humbling experience, because, like, you know, coming back to revisit a character that had been, like, you know, dead to me for so long. Because, like, you know, I hadn't touched Joe in, like, 7 years, I think. And, you know, to come back and sort of be like, right, okay, what's this cat? What's he all about? Can I remember this guy? But then also doing the show, but also watching the new cast of characters who are in the position now that I was back then. And I tell you what, they're really, really good. I remember we had a scene where we were sat on the stage and they were in the audience. And we were watching the camera go past them, and they're sort of improvising and bouncing off each other and fun stuff coming up. I turned to Jack Bentz, who plays Grayson, and I was like, oh, they're really good, aren't they? These are the guys that are going to be chewing at our heels before long. We need to up our game.
It's a good thing, though, I think, because it keeps you on your toes. But equally, it's, you know, I'm sure when you were first starting out, you know, there were people who were seeing you guys on set and going, oh, here comes, the, you know, the next generation. And
I mean, I don't know about that. I don't remember being that self-assured. I don't remember being that snappy and confident and sure of myself. But, yeah, maybe. Who knows?
Well, one of the things I was going to ask about it later, but now seems like an appropriate time as we're on Bad Education. We've had three divers on this program. We've had Gary Hunt, the guy who does the Red Bull cliff diving series, and we've had two of Team GB's Olympians who were at the London 2012 Olympics. But I don't think any of them could have competed with you and Jack on that 5 meter board for your synchronized effort. And I just want you to take our viewers and our audience through when you first even read the script and was like, this is what we're going to do, to how it ended up as I'd have to say a polished gem.
I was, the night I got sent through the script, I was doing stand up in somewhere. I think it might have been, where was it? It doesn't matter. That's literally not important to the story. But, like, I was waiting to go on and the email came through. And I was like, right, I'll go do this and I never read of that. And it's in episode one, so it was one of the first things that I read. And I was like, oh, crikey, are they sure about this? Then a little bit later, like after some email communique, we had a day, myself and Jack, where we went to the Hammersmith Lido to practice with a stunt coordinator. And basically, we were told, like, yeah, bomb for most of the way. But once you start really reaching the water, just extend those feet so that you can break the water, not with your, like, your knees and your thighs. And so we did that. And then, I mean, it was quite easy to forget that what we had been taught, because we did that just before principal photography started. And that shot was actually the last shot of the series that we filmed. So there was a good 7 weeks in between our practice at the Hammersmith and then that bit at the end. And I think if you watch it back, I seem to recall this. Jack slightly forgets to extend his legs before he hits the water. And boy, did he have bruised thighs after that.
I think one thing all the divers we've had on the show that they start with is the injuries we
have. I mean it's like if you don't do it properly, it's like hitting concrete.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't want to do that from 5 meters.
Now coming, I guess, a little bit off bad education, things obviously moved on and you had these various ups and downs, but it's not just been you, you've had kind of people alongside you. And one of the things again that we speak about with our guests is actually like the home team, if you like, the people that have supported you. And I know you've got Michael Ford in your corner amongst others. So can you just talk us through, I guess, having both friends, family, agents, people like that around you, and how that's contributed to your journey?
We'll start with Michael, because you know, he's my agent, and I was linked with him after, I think it was at the wrap party of Bad Education Series 2. Because to sort of roll back in the chronology a bit, that amateur musical theatre group that I was with, they sort of set up a kind of cottage agency, which was essentially a ploy to get us all on Spotlight, the casting website, which at the time all you needed was representation. It's a lot more stringent now. You wouldn't be able to get away with that sort of cowboy business. But so I was on Spotlight, but the agency had folded because all the people were moving on. I was heading off to university. But I still had my year of Spotlight, which is how the Bad Education guys spotted me. So I was represented by them up until Series 2. And at this rap party, I got talking to a guy who knew a guy who used to be a PA for Michael at his agency. And he put me in contact. We met up. We chatted. He agreed to represent me. That was, that'll be coming up on 10 years this year. Only agent, professional agent I've ever had. He's always got my back. He's always looked after me. And, you know, we're out here making money together. So that's sort of like, you know, the professional support that I've had. My mum has always been my biggest supporter and biggest fan. Always, you know, geeing me up whenever I needed it and, you know, supporting me and my dreams. And, you know, in return, I support her back. Like, you know, it's, you know, boring financial, but, you know, and that's the way. I mean, you know, I dread to think how much money she spent in petrol ferrying me around Essex during the teenage amateur musical theatre days. So it's the least I can do. When Bad Education came out for the first time, I was still at university and, like, you know, I had my group of friends. We had a group called the Holloway Players, who were basically improv comedy. And talking again about making sure that we're grounded, they rinsed me like nobody's business. When it came out, oh, here he is, TV's Ethan Lawrence, Mr. Comedy, old Biebs over here. So that was very important to my growth, to make sure that there's no tall poppies over here. And, you know, most of them are still friends to this day. And, like, you know, some of them have even ended up in the performing arts industry as well. And it's just all good to see. It's all good supporting each other, good circle of friends. And, I mean, nowadays it's like you know, it's not even of note that I work as a professional actor. It's, you know, it's, that's just Ethan. That's just what he does. Like, you know, that's how he earns his cash.
You mentioned there around growth. And I think something that, again, we hear from a lot of our guests is around the failures, if you like, because actually they learn a lot more from that. So what's been, if you like, your most valuable failure or series of failures that have actually almost allowed you to get to where you are now?
The big and most obvious glaring one is that I've probably had more job interviews than you've had hot dinners. 99.9% of the time, I don't get the job. Because, you know, it's a crowded field and, you know, it can be any reason, but it, you know, it's that always keeps you humble. Like, knowing for a fact that you could go up for say 100 auditions in a year and you might get one, that maybe. So in general, sort of over the grand scheme of things, that was, you know, that's a constant reminder that, like, you know, failure is always an option and usually is the option. In terms of sort of like the kind of grand scale thing, I mean, I've spoken about this in various places before, but 2018, essentially my career fell apart. We were talking about momentum earlier, and like all the momentum had gone. Like, there was nothing in the books. There was auditions were coming up, but I just wasn't landing any of them. And it came to the point where I was like, well, you know, I have to do something to earn some money, because, like, you know, we're looking at months here of potentially no work at all. So I took up pizza delivery with a view to doing that, sort of working nights and auditioning during the day. And, you know, it was a stopgap thing, but I was thinking to myself, this will be fine. Like, you know, it'll pick up again in a couple of months. And then a year passed and it hadn't really picked up. you know, I was still working hard, but, you know, it just wasn't clicking. And that's, you know, to, again, sort of jump ahead in the story. That's when Afterlife Series 2 came along, pulling me out of the depths of despondency just when I needed it. But, you know, that's another thing. It's always good to look back on that and the first 9 months of the COVID-19 pandemic, sort of looking back on it and being like, yeah, this is very fragile. It's a fragile industry. It's a fragile job that I have, and it can and will go away if I don't, you know, keep it going.
Well, we'll jump ahead to the Afterlife stuff in a minute, but, you know, you touched on the pandemic there, and something I noted from your journey was, again, another big break, if you like, in the middle of March in 2020, and the opportunity to move into, I believe it was Horrible Histories. And
actually, yes.
Then, I mean, if I'd said to anybody, go back to March 2020 in the UK, they would come out with one answer. But for you, you had, you know, an incredible opportunity, which then a week later was almost not so much taken away, you know, in the bigger picture in the context of things. But what was that like as an emotional journey, kind of, especially off the back of the 2018 pizza job, you know, things starting to pick up in 2019, and then 2020, you're going, right, we're back on the wagon. And then that happens.
Well, it's an interesting thing, that, because my final audition day for that was, I believe, March 16th of 2020, sorry. And people were already, like, you know, nervous and everything like that. And I think back to that day, because I came up to London by train, went across by tube, went to do some voiceover stuff in a tight, unventilated room, left that, and then went to the audition in another unventilated room. And then tube back and train home. I didn't get COVID. I don't know how I don't know how that happened. But I found out on the 18th of March that I got the job. And then on the 23rd of March, obviously, everything shut down. So it was sort of like, but again, there was sort of that optimism. You know, it's weird thinking about it, looking back. But like when the lockdown happened initially, it was like, ah, this will all be over in a couple of weeks. And then, oh, it'll be a couple of months. Oh, it'll be August. Oh, it'll be. And in the end, like, we didn't start shooting on Horrible Histories until like the middle of 2021, which is, you know, a year and a half. That's a long time to be sat thinking, and when are we going to go? When's the time? And like, in that time, like, my contribution to it had shrunk slightly. Like, there were budgetary constraints and availability and things like that. So I ended up getting into what they call category B, which is essentially more of a kind of mercenary position where they sort of just bring you in for a few sketches here and there, as opposed to sort of like the main bulk. So, you know, it was disheartening in a way, but like, it was amazing job to do. Like, you know, I don't know about yourself, but like, I loved the books as a kid. So like, never have like a dream job. I was like, I'm doing Horrible Histories. This is crazy. And then they had me back for re-recording the next one, and well, the next two. We did two series back to back, and I was upgraded to main cast. And I learned why everyone looked so tired whenever I arrived.
Well, talking about, I guess, recording lengths there, the show that you went on to with Afterlife has been relatively explored with the sense of more tighter shooting day, shall we say. But there's a couple of things that I want to pick up on that. Obviously, I'm a massive fan of the show. I think on the day it came out, I was getting a train to Edinburgh, the third season, and I remember downloading every episode in the morning and then watching it on the train back to back on the way to Scotland and thinking, it's so good. You know, it's the kind of thing you can watch over and over again. But when we put out that we were going to speak to you, the volume of questions we got in was fantastic, but the range of them was really interesting. And you can see people dig a lot more into the story and all the different characters and stuff. And one of the things that I want to pick up on is Ricky Gervais is quite well known for kind of casting people knowing what they can do and then almost building the characters, if you like, and the story around them. So to have gone from that first season where you had, you know, a relatively small exposure to that season, and then actually getting told, well, actually, we like what we've seen and we're now going to build this around you. What was that like?
Again, it's important to frame it in the context of where I was personally as well, which is like, you know, that was basically the last thing that I did before Pizza Delivery. You know, it was 90 minutes on the Afterlife set, just playing a couple of recorders with my nose and then off I go. So, you know, I was extraordinarily grateful for the opportunity to be upgraded to main cast. And, you know, I, at the time, like, you know, I hadn't read a script, so I didn't really know what the plan was. But I was confident that wherever it was going to be at the very least funny. So that was an exciting opportunity. And then when it came through and I saw, actually, I have actually got quite a lot to do here. This is great. You know, it's sort of, it helped me build my confidence back up, which, you know, naturally had taken a knock in that year. But like, you know, the fact that Ricky, you know, not to toot my own horn, I guess, but I'd seen something there and had been like, I can work with this. I can shape this and into something. You know, I was very, very, was and am very grateful for the opportunity that he presented to me. And, you know, then series two and then series three. And it's, you know, it was a joy to do. Really, really, truly amazing job. And, yeah, it's a sort of gave me the sort of second wind to get me into the sort of second act of my career.
Yeah, I mean, the impact that having somebody else believing in you, if you like, and actually giving you those opportunities, especially after the journey you'd been on to that point, I think there's a lot to be said for other people and making sure that they actually recognize, in some cases, they've got the capacity to give people a huge confidence boost by sometimes what might be seen as a relatively small break. But in your world, actually, that was a huge stepping stone given the
time. It was absolutely everything. And it sort of goes to what we were speaking about earlier, sort of like the kind of reputation management as an employee, as a worker, is so important. Because, like, you know, if I turned up for that 90 minutes and was rubbish, or, like, you know, wasn't a team player or anything like that, he wouldn't have given me a second thought. I'd have been out the door. But, you know, I conducted myself with the you know, the professionalism that I expect from anyone in this job, and, you know, did my thing, and then it came good in the end. And it sort of it demonstrates that theory that, you know, you put in the work, you know, be a team player, and people will look after you in return.
So I'm expecting to see kind of a massive viral uptake of acting students applying with showreels of recorders stuck up their nose in the hope that that's going to
get. Oh, I tell you, it's already been done, mate. It's already been done. Leave it.
And picking up again on one of the Afterlife things, the question again we had in about the bath scene.
Yes.
And again, when you look at the script like that, obviously you've got your comedy head on, so you know immediately, just reading probably the first line, it's going to be ridiculously funny. But when you look back on, I guess, the end products on it, it's the kind of clip that I must have watched 100 times on various platforms and gone, it must have, knowing how many outtakes you guys have shooting those programs, it must have been the funniest thing to film and the hardest thing to get in a take.
To a degree, yeah. I mean, we get a lot of outtakes, but we work fast. And I think because of, I mean, it, honestly, like the filming, like, conditions of actually shooting in a bathroom with a live bath, it's uncomfortable. It's a tight space. Like, you know, we've got two cameras in there. So therefore two cameras, two camera teams. So we're already up to like six or seven people
in a
domestic bathroom. Like, this wasn't like there were two bath scenes, and in the second one, it was a more wide open room that we'd fitted to make it look like it was a bathroom. But the first bathroom was just a bathroom, and it's, yeah, you wouldn't want like 10 people in there. That's crazy. So I think we were pretty keen to sort of get off it as quickly as possible. But you know, obviously we still had our outtakes. We still worked to get through it because it is intrinsically a weird situation to be in, and the natural response to that is to is the laugh, because it's awkward, you know, like you've got a semi-naked man sat in a bath and we're all filming this and pretending this is normal.
One of the things, again, just kind of to round off the afterlife stuff, the, you know, I know you've spoken previously about the talents, if you like, of David Bradley and people like that, and, you know, some really touching stuff. And it was a very interesting program in the sense that it interweaved the really heavy emotional stuff with such laughter, you know, and so well. It wasn't like it came across in any way coarse or anything like that. Like, it was done fantastically. And, you know, we mentioned around imposter syndrome earlier, and when you spend time around some of these actors that just deliver such heavy, if you like, performances, what are the kind of golden threads, if you like, or what are your takeaways when you've come off sets or seen scenes like that and you think, wow, they do X or they do Y, or you ask them, what's kind of been that, your experience of that?
Well, it's so odd, because, like, you know, being quote unquote good at acting is sort of so, it's so ephemeral. It's like smoke. Like, you know, you can't really, it's not a tangible thing that you can say, oh, I see what they did there. You know, because it's not really sort of the tactic or the technique. All I will say is that there's been many times in my career when I've been watching an actor perform for camera, and I'm watching them and I'm like, oh, that's the difference. And I can't put my finger on it, but it's just the way they conduct themselves, like, you know, the way that they steer themselves through the dialogue. And, you know, it inspires me to try and be better. Because, like, I can't look at what I do with any sort of objectivity. Like, you know, I do what I do, and then I watch it back and I'm like, I mean, I guess it was good. I don't know. People seem to like it. But, like, you know, I'm also my own worst critic, so that doesn't help. But, you know, I don't know if anyone looks at what I do and thinks to themselves that. Probably not. But, like, it's again, it's sort of that kind of sort of humbling experience when you watch someone, especially someone who's been doing it a long while, and, like, they can do it, like, just as easy as breathing. It seems to come so naturally to them. Like, yeah, you mentioned David Bradley. You know, I've worked with him twice now, once on Bad Education for one episode and once on Afterlife. And he's just magnificent. Like, you know, just the way he gets through dialogue and just the way he performs, it's so subtle and so natural. And I'm very, very jealous of how good people are. Because I sort of, yeah, like I said, there's no, sort of no objectivity to what I do, so I get in my own head a lot. But so I can't speak to how I do. But yeah, it's there's a difference there, I feel.
And there's something that comes with time, I guess. And one of the one of the quotes that I love from somebody we're hoping to get on the podcast, but I know away from my podcasting life, if you like, is a lady called Mel Marshall, who's an Olympic gold medal coach, and she talks about having people in your life that give you roots to grow but wings to fly. And I feel like you've had a few moments kind of on your journey where you've been given those opportunities to fly, if you like, and just really wondered who, in when you look back, and I know you're still relatively early into your career, you know, you've got many years ahead of you, but who are those people for sure based on what we've seen so far, but who are those people who you kind of look back and go, they were fantastic for me, that moment, that bit of advice, that bit of support, or something that you just learned and picked up along the way? Who are those people in your life?
I think this is a good opportunity to shout out casting directors, who, you know, do quite a hard job that is sort of very sort of, there's no thanks there. There's no casting director awards, or maybe there is. There probably is, actually. But, like, you know, they're essentially, this is going to sound worse than it is, but you'll understand what I mean. They are essentially the gatekeepers through whom you must go to get into work. And I've been fortunate enough to audition with a great number of them. I'd like to specifically shout out Tracy Gillam, who was the casting director on a few things. I think near enough half my career is owed to Tracy Gillam, but specifically Afterlife as well. She cast me on that. And like we've spoken, and she likes having me around. Because, you know, even if the part's not entirely right for me, it's good to have me as an option, she says. Because, like, you know, she'll know that I'll do it to the best of my abilities. And so she can present that to the grown-ups and be like, well, look, maybe something like this, maybe this is something we're not considering. So casting directors, I would say, every single one of them, angels on this earth. And, like, I mean, to be honest with you, like, any sort of creative team that, you know, took a punt on me, like early doors, especially like with Bad Education, like I was nothing and no one. Like, you know, I was a, you know, unshaven, addled mess, like rolling up to an audition thing, like in a big coat because it was February. Just being like, oh yeah, yeah, I'll be in your show. But you know, they again, it's that thing of seeing something in me, and they were happy to take that risk. They were happy to take that punt instead of going for someone more established or someone who they knew. They took a punt on a stranger, and like, you know, to have that sort of faith in me is again, it's humbling. Like, you know, it makes you feel like, okay, well, maybe I am all right at this, actually. You know, for all those times that I questioned myself and questioned sort of like my abilities, to every single time I've been cast in something, that's a sequence of decisions that have been made at a high level that have gone, this is what we want for this. And like, you know, especially for something as personal as Afterlife for Ricky, like, you know, because he was saying like how it sort of marries the comedy and the tragedy. And I mean, God forbid he got it wrong. Like, you know, if he'd made the wrong call and like we ended up with something that was trite or like, you know, simpering or something like that, it would have been a disaster. But, you know, he's a low-key amazing talent at recognizing talent. And that's sort of how it ended up. So yeah, long story short to your question, basically everyone he's ever taken a punt on me.
It was it was really interesting watching it, because one of my friends introduced me to it and I didn't really know what to expect. And then about 2.5 hours later, when we'd watched all 6 episodes, because that's how you generally watch it, because you just, I can't not watch the next one. It's such a strange experience, because when you're, let's say, a wake of a family member or something like that, and you're there for a deeply sad reason, and it's an incredibly emotional day, but often you're pulling out some of the happy memories and the things that, but it's something that until you've experienced it with close family, it's really hard to articulate. And to watch somebody bring that into a whole show, if you like, and a whole series where there's this ongoing grief journey, but equally there are these different characters that all bring the humor to life, if you like. And actually that was, it was a real balancing act. And I think it evolved quite like the grief journey, if you like, over the 3 seasons, where actually the tone, if you like, of the whole series kind of got closer and closer to some level of closure. But it was the interaction of all the different characters that made that so special. So it wasn't like it was a stand-up piece or a series of stand-up where it was one person coordinating. It required so many different people to bring their A game to the table. And I think that's what makes it so special. Every single character in their own way contributes to that journey that everyone will go on at some point. And I think that's why it was so well received, because everyone at some point will experience grief and the people around them will do their best to help them on that journey.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's you know, there was a lot of, like, you know, discussion at the time, think pieces, like, you know, saying this is a comedy about grief, this is a comedy about closure and about moving on, and it is that. But I think in a much more simple way, it's a story about a small town containing small people who live small lives, and that's fine. You know, it's people who, you know, don't have pretensions to greatness or, like, you know, we're going to go anywhere or change the world or cure cancer or whatever. It's about people. It's about real people who muddle through. And, like, you know, we all, in a community, like, you help each other. You lift each other up. And I think, in a way, Afterlife's much more about that than it is about, you know, oh, grief, oh, tragedy, Shakespeare. It's about small people and small lives.
Excellent. Well, there's a couple more funny ones I have to delve into, because there are, the fact there is an outtakes means there is probably lots of stuff on your journey that we've never seen.
Yes.
And now you've been doing it a while, looking back, what's the funniest thing or funniest things maybe that you look back and think that was hilarious, but it's never seen the light of day?
Well, so difficult, because like the way that those outtakes are put together, for Afterlife, is that, like, you know, it's because more often than not, outtakes aren't actually that funny. Like, you know, for all the talk of sort of, like, you know, all these outtakes are great, you're seeing like the best of.
Yeah.
Because more often than not, an outtake will be you forget the line and you go, oh, I forgot. Can I just, what is it? All right, yeah. And then you do it. And that's not funny or interesting to watch, as you can tell from what I just did. So to be honest with you, like, in terms of the stuff, I don't really think there's anything that is really, really funny that either didn't already end up in the finished product or ended up in an outtake set. Because it's, you know, it's watching people fail is funny. But more often than not, it's just a very small thing. So I would encourage everyone to go and watch the outtakes for Afterlife.
Well, then looking back on the stuff we obviously have seen, whether it's stuff that's made it into the final cut or the outtakes that are now going viral, what's been your funniest and most joyful, especially being in, you know, the realm of comedy, what's the bits that stand with you and go, that was belly laughing fun for hours and we still laugh about it now?
I think back to series 3 of Afterlife. It's the scene where I've moved in with Brian Gittins, played brilliantly by David L. And he is regaling in a long, unbroken monologue the story of him making a porno with his ex-wife and Rolly Carter. And when David L. gets on a roll of improvising, and when he starts, he is a runaway train. It is so difficult to maintain grace and decorum and dignity. So once he's on one, it's crazy. And that scene was so funny. Like, every time he introduced a new element, I was just crying with laughter. You could hear Ricky in the back at the monitors also crying with laughter. The crew were barely holding it together. And he's just sat there just saying these awful things. And I think about that at least once a week. And just the experience of shooting that.
I want you to cast your mind back into, let's say, pre-university Ethan. And if I'd have said to you, let's put yourself in the shoes of the storytelling grandfather talking back to pre-university Ethan, and you'd have said, right, this is it. Everything stops right now. And up to this point, you've done, you know, you've had this time with Jack Whitehall, you've done the stuff with Ricky Gervais and all these other incredible actors. What do you look back and you're most proud of? What are whether the scenes or the programs or the experiences you've had with people that you look back and go, you know, that was special?
It's a recent one, you know, doing Horrible Histories, series 10 and 11. It is the hardest I've ever worked as an actor. You know, we worked from July through to December. It's the longest job I've ever been on. We did 24 episodes, 1,048 pages of script. And I personally played 107 different characters, wow, which is a lot. And like, I remember on the last day, we wrapped on, I think it might have been the 16th of December. I think that was a Friday. And we'd finished. And it was all done. And it was almost like just shell shock of having come through and done so much, especially in that last push. When we were in a studio, we were doing 5 or 6 sketches a day. And it was just so relentless. But I look back on that time and my God, I was so happy. I was so happy to be leaping out of bed every morning, going in and be like, okay, what madness today then? What fresh hell? And I'm so proud of what we did. I'm so proud of myself for, you know, having the gumption to be able to do it. And equally a source of pride for me as well is the fact that despite the overwhelming nature of the schedule, I still found time to do Bad Education. And I still found time to audition for other jobs that is, like, you know, have carried me into this year, which is great. And I'm just, yeah, that whole period, I am just so proud of myself and so proud of what we achieved. Yeah, I think that was a banner job for me. If you didn't know how to be an actor to start with, you do 6 months in Horrible Histories, you'll have to learn pretty fast.
Well, we're going to come on, or we'll finish off with just, I guess, a bit of a cap on to future projects, because we know you've got a lot coming up this year. There's one more question I want to ask before we dive into the quick fire questions to finish. And that is, you know, there's so many viral clips, if you like, but there's so much content that Ricky's put out on the years, certainly that I've been watching him. And we all watch it from our side of the lens, if that makes sense. You've seen it from the other side. So casting our minds back to the first question asked around three words, I'll give you a few more than three words, but how would you summarize the experience of having now worked with him behind the scenes and actually, you know, on an expansive and hugely successful project? What was your kind of reflective experience on that?
I mean, looking back, it was an extraordinary job to do. And like, you know, it's that there's a tendency, I think, a lot, and you know, this isn't criticizing the question, by the way, but there's sort of a tendency to sort of be like, you know, oh, what was the best job? What was the best thing? And you know, most jobs are pretty similar. But I do think there was something special about Afterlife. And I think a lot of that comes down to management. You know, Ricky was the star, yes, but he was also the writer and the director. And so he was wearing a lot of hats, but it meant that a lot of the power was focused in one man. And, you know, in any workplace, like, you know, the fish rots from the head, right? So if he's, like, if he's creating a good working atmosphere, then the whole job is a joy. And that's one of the things that I really do look back on. Like, we had such freedom to play. And it was so supportive, both for, like, you know, not only cast, but also crew. Like, you know, we had the space to experiment. We had the opportunity to, like, really try and find something that may not have been there in the text. Like, the story I often tell is the fact that my character and Brian Gittins basically didn't really have any interaction at all. But over the course of the filming, like, you know, if we ended up in the back of shot or something, we'd naturally gravitate towards each other. And it was there that we realized that, oh, Christ, there's sort of like a kind of chemistry there between two actors. And, you know, you're never going to know that unless you actually see it happen. And like, you know, cause it's not something you can test. But like, you know, we started adding little bits, and then suddenly come series three, I essentially did all my scenes with Brian Gittins. And that wouldn't happen often, I think, on other jobs. Yeah, but the ability that Ricky has to be adaptable, but also recognize that, like, you know, there are elements of performance and elements of, like, you know, bringing the script from, like, page to life. There are these uncontrollable elements that you can't know about, but you have to roll with them because at the end of the day, it's funny. And I think that ultimately sums Afterlife up. Like, it was such a fun job to do because we had the freedom. And we ended up creating something brilliant. So yeah, that was a damn good job, actually, looking back on it.
Okay, well, I'm going to dive into some quick fire ones. I know, or a little birdie has told me that you're a massive podcast fan.
Oh yes.
So I want, what are your top three?
Top three. Here we go. One time, no thought. So I've collaborated a lot of times with a podcast called Cheap Show, which is two men who are far too old to be doing the stuff that they do. as it brands itself as sort of like an economy comedy podcast, but it's got this kind of sprawling meta universe of characters and games and weird things like that. I've collaborated with them a few times, and it's always been a great laugh. So if you like your humor kind of mucky and bottom focused, I would absolutely recommend that. In terms of factual history stuff, there's a podcast called Behind the Bastards, which is hosted by Robert Evans, who was formerly a writer at Cracked.com, where essentially they look at the worst people in all of history and sort of tell a kind of potted biography. Learn a lot of stuff from that. Very, very interesting. Great fun. Now let's sing. I've got to come up with a third. I do listen to a lot, you see. I'm going to go with NADPOD. Not another D&D podcast made for by Headgum Studios. It's essentially a sort of actual play D&D podcast where they do that, and it's a lot of fun. They're currently in the middle of their third series, but you can start from one, start from two. They've got a couple of bonus ones. Oh, it's a lot of fun. Fun for all the family. So sometimes.
All our listeners and viewers are going to be going straight away and checking those three out. Onto the subject of books, because I know before the acting dream was the writer's dream. So.
Oh, yeah. I've always been firmly committed to picking careers which are unstable and dangerous.
Well, now, having gone on the acting journey, obviously you still kept, I guess, that passion of reading alive. So what's the book that, again, grand old age of 30, you look back and think, that book had quite a big impact on me?
Oh, that's tough, that one. It's going to sound like a bit of a sort of left field pick, but it's a book called Jam by Benjamin Yahtzee Croshaw, who some people may know as the voice of Zero Punctuation on the Escapist website. It's genuinely one of the funniest books I've ever read. It's set in Australia, in Brisbane, I think, and a man walks out onto his balcony and looks down at the streets below, and there is a meter high coverage of the ground in jam, man-eating jam. And what follows is a kind of apocalyptic journey through a city that has been torn apart by human-eating jam. It's a very, very curious book and very, very funny indeed. I would highly recommend that. That's one I go back to quite a lot.
We'll make sure we link the podcast and the book in the show notes when we put the episode out. A slightly more, I guess, serious one, but certainly a reflective one. I don't say this to yourself because I think everyone's journey has kind of almost had an element of fate to it and it's gone its way. So you wouldn't necessarily say anything to your younger self, but to young people that are in your shoes when you were 14, 15, 16, trying to find your way in the world. Having now been on the journey you've been on, what are the pearls of wisdom, or you think, I really wish young people would have been, or people my age would have been told that when I was 14, 15, 16?
Tricky one, that. So, I mean, I'm going to sort of frame it within the terms of 15 or 16 year old kids who may want to end up in the same career that I did, which is constantly do stuff. Like, you know, even if it feels like, you know, you're on a hiding to nothing. Yeah, we've mentioned a couple of times actually during this chat that, like, there's no way you can teach acting without experiencing acting. So just get out and do stuff. You'll find a local dramatic group. Go talk to them. Put something on, like, write something, do something. Like, there's sort of a kind of, I mean, it's difficult because, like, my journey is so backwards. Like, you know, it's not supposed to happen the way that it happened. Like, you know, I just sort of lucked into it and then just kept going. But after that initial break, like we spoke about the graph, but in many ways it's just making your own luck. So if you are genuinely really truly committed to this, you want to do acting, and you know, nothing in the world can stop you, just make sure you are 100% committed and constantly working on your craft and working on yourself. Like, there's no such thing as doing too much, I would say.
That's a lovely message. And before we finish, I have to ask about what's coming up this year. I know there's a lot of things. So we've mentioned Horrible Histories already. Are both seasons coming out this year, or is it one?
So I think, because the reason why we did two is because we obviously lost a year owing to COVID. So the first series will come out sort of, I think, kind of sporadically over the course of this year. And then series 11 will do the same, but in 2024. So be on the lookout. Obviously, when stuff starts coming out, I'll be posting it all over my socials because I am nothing if not attention rich.
And is there any other projects that we should keep an eye out for?
Magic Mike 3, The Last Dance. This is such a bizarre thing. So at the beginning of 2022, I had just come off a bout of having had COVID. My brain was in a fog. I could barely concentrate. Audition season started. I couldn't learn lines. Like, it was just that has gone. It hasn't even really returned. I've had to relearn how to learn lines, which was tough. But I got quite deep on a job that I won't name because they were very kind and sweet. But I did a lot of auditions for it, a lot of prep work, worked really, really hard and didn't get it. Got close, but didn't get it. So during the call with Michael Ford, who I mentioned earlier, my agent, breaking the bad news, he goes, yeah, we didn't get this, but bit of a weird one, Steven Soderbergh has been on the phone. You do know Magic Mike, right? And I'm like, what now? And it turns out they were offering me the part of Woody the stage manager in Magic Mike 3 The Last Dance. Didn't need to audition or anything. They were just straight up offering me it, and that was on the back of Afterlife. So just like we were saying, the sort of, like, you know, sowing the seeds and, like, you know, the little breaks here can then lead to other things. Who could have possibly known that at the beginning of 2018, going in for 90 minutes on Afterlife to play some recorders with my nose would end up with me working with Steven Soderbergh, Channing Tatum and Salma Hayek and Magic Mike 3 The Last Dance. That's out on February 10th. Go and see it. I imagine it's going to be quite good. I myself haven't seen it yet. Hopefully I will in due course. But yeah, that was mad. That's a mad thing that happened to me. So be on the lookout for that as well.
Fantastic. Well, I know you're really active on the socials, so we'll make sure we signpost everybody to what you're up to, especially your TikTok, which I know is, you know, a work unto itself.
I mean, it's on a bit of a hiatus at the minute, but because I can't think of anything. I'm drained. I've got nothing. I mean, the most of the things I've been posting up on TikTok recently were just pictures of me in Horror Weird Streets. Because, I mean, that's content, isn't it?
It certainly is. And to be honest, with all that other stuff coming up this year and the amount of filming and stuff that you've put in the bank over the last 6 months, you do actually probably deserve a little rest. But we'll make sure we signpost everyone to that. And just a huge thank you both for sharing your time, but also the work that you've done so far, because I think, you know, the wider world, we don't get face to face, if you like, with a lot of the people that bring us the joy on screen. And I think it's really important that you know, like you said, you're your own worst critic. And I'm sure a lot of people have that imposter syndrome of, was it good? How was it received? And all those sorts of things. So a big thank you on behalf of our audience for sharing some time with us, but also for your content you put out, because it is fantastic.
Well, honestly, it's my pleasure. And, you know, there's no point doing anything that I do if people don't watch it. So, I'm very, very appreciative of anyone who takes the time to only watch anything I do. As I said, I'm just a hack and a fraud. So keep supporting this. Thank you very much.
A huge thank you for joining us today. You can connect with today's guest and all our Rogue Monkey podcast socials through the links below this episode. If you're involved in a business, we would also love for you to check out our collaboration with Richard Cheetham MBE, our episode 44 guest, the link to which is also in the show notes. Finally, just a quick reminder to subscribe to the podcast, however you're joining us today, and please do pass this episode on to at least one person you think would take inspiration from it. Have a great week, and thanks again for being part of the Rogue Monkey podcast community.